Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is about the sixth episode of a book called Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, a paperback, a fairly thick paperback, which is getting a bit worn out, being dragged about the place as I'm reading steadily through it. It's 580 pages. I'm up to page 56, having done a few chapters on the mythology, being mythology, if I can just break it up. There's the mythology to support social structure, mythology to support culture, architectural mythology, or that of Stonehenge. But now we're getting onto Terrors of the Sky. And as I'm reading about it, I'm finding, as I'm researching back some of the ideas, I find are true, and the stuff that I knew is incorrect. Some of the stuff they say there is incorrect or just inadequate. And there's also some missing stuff, and I found out about zodiacal light, or zodiacal light. This is light from little dust particles, not from the planets, but from just little smashed up, minced up planets. And in very dark skies, you can see this stretch of mist in the ecliptic plane, this glow, the ecliptic plane of things, the light scattering off it, scattering. So that's interesting stuff to find out. And of course, all the time, little technical innovations here. I've got a little lapel mic to record with. So hopefully it's a little bit better. Unfortunately, and previously when I was recording, I was very tired. The last one I think I did was an analysis of angular momentum and the influence on seasons and drift of whatever it is, the precession of the Earth's axis. I think there's generally confusion there. I didn't do a very good job that time. I was just ran out. My batteries ran out totally. I began to yawn all the way through it. Hopefully I'll be able to do a good job this time. Now this one is chapter 4, episode 6, because I had to preface and pre-Midian chapter. And this is Terrors of the Sky. And this is a Babylonian table of portents from 1600 BC. And I should say, that's one of the things that I've picked up is missing from here is some understanding of some linking Greek legends, which are extensions of Babylonian mythology. And so the Babylonians miss out of here because he hasn't gone in deep enough. Okay, on the 20th day, an eclipse befalls. The king is slain and nobody seizes the throne. On the 21st day, another eclipse, devastation, corpses are found throughout the country. So that's eclipses. Now, I think what they used to do is, I think they described it here, or I may have read ahead, I can't remember, where they when they're able to predict an eclipse, the real king goes in hiding, they have a pretend king for a while, and then they slay him after the eclipse, so that bad things all go to him. Now, this is Achilleus of Paros, 714 to 676 BC, so that's a fair... Well, yeah, that's okay. I'm just subtracting the other way. He's not too old. Describing a solar eclipse. Nothing can be sworn impossible, since Zeus, father of the Olympians, made night of midday, hiding the light from the slanting shine, and saw fear upon man. So this is a general thing, eclipses of the sun. This is another phenomena of the sun, is eclipses. So it's the sun itself, the Earth's orbit, and then finally thrown on top of the soup mix is Earth's mixes. You also have the sun's travel through the galaxies. So I think it takes 100,000 years. I find this just incredible to go through. So it's 100,000 years per orbit. Through our galaxy, and a quarter of it's 100 million years going through our galaxy, and 250,000 years for our galaxy to move. So we're actually hopping around our arms while the arms themselves as density waves are sitting and orbiting. That's a complicated thing to see. I have a beautiful class exercise. People understand it, but then it hooks into nothing in the syllabus. But it's really interesting about eclipses, and if you just read, as I have, I'm not saying I'm great or anything. I've struggled through the Latin, learning more about Latin and learning about my lack of knowledge of Latin, going through the Livy and various things. They have equally in their discussion of, say, like we have an analysis of the Great Depression or World War II. They will have it, but it will equally have just references to star signs and symbols. You know, they live in a rich, superstitious society. And you have to understand that we also live in a superstitious society as well. We have things which we put great importance to, but really practically don't have it. So this is a superstitious society. Auroras, eclipses, those great celestial dramas, are two of the most awe-inspiring occurrences in nature. Obviously my head is comet. And for thousands of years, our fear of them has trumped over whatever the scholars of the ancient world and onwards have told us about their causes. And this is an important thing, that our understanding is slowly, the fear came first and then the understanding came afterwards. Auroras are the flares that appear far above our heads. Oh, yeah, okay, these are atmospheric auroras. Okay, so this is the Aurora Borealis. The most spectacular and the best known being the Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis, in the Northern Hemisphere, and Southern Lights, Aurora Australis, in the Southern. They are often the start off as a mild glow, hugging the horizon. Bright patches, called surfaces by the scientists, may follow. Then arcs appear, stretching, quote, like fluorescent basket handles across the sky, end quote. Finally, the entire heavens will be wreathed in celestial fire. Auroras typically swirl 50 to 20 miles above the Earth. So this is in the ozone layer, up around there. So, you know, atmosphere is pretty low. Although some have come as close as 35 miles. Or miles. Oh, that's sort of high. Miles is sort of deep space. So 50 miles is... 50 miles is getting into deep space. The flood of particles shot out of the sun reacts endlessly with atoms and ions in the atmosphere to generate photons, the basic particles of light. And when enough of these collisions occur with sufficient intensity, they set off blazing displays. Okay, I think that this is deeply confused. Deeply confused. So he hasn't actually said that the an aurora is a combination of a plasma and metastable atoms. So when you ionize, excite the atmosphere, you create metastable atoms, and these hang around for 20 minutes or more and then deposit their energy out as light, the basic fluorescence. Given the Earth's rotation, because the arriving particles are constantly changing directions as they strike the upper air, the auroras seem to move across the sky. Oh, I'm going to sneeze. I think that's complete rubbish. So the direction of the cosmic rays, the magnetic field bends them in, and there's an interaction between the plasma and the magnetic field. So the plasma itself generates its own magnetic field, and therefore the magnetic field ripples. I'm just going to really sneeze. Excuse me. What really happens here is, like lightning, the plasma generates a magnetic field which directs it, so lightning can actually bend and fork. And similar to this, any glow discharge can follow the general magnetic field, but it has its own magnetic field which builds up. It's sort of like a bus, where the actual bus people have an election about where they want to go and visit, but that bus still has to get to the from point A to point B. But they can say, "Well, look, we want to stop at off at this sandwich shop and do this." They always seem to move. Okay, well, they do. They are visible mainly in latitudes of the Arctic Circle, most frequently during the equinox. That is when the sun, the magnetic field, is not either pointing towards or away from the sun. So at the equinox, it's pointing at an angle. Ultimately, if you imagine a 90 degree angle, it's pointing at that. The rest of the time, it's, if you looked at the axis of the magnetic field and looked at the compass, the sun would move away from 90 degrees. When it's at 90 degrees, the energy doesn't flow one way or the other. It's interesting that there's these radiation belts around the sun, radiation belts around the Earth, the Van Allen belt. These are high energy particles which are trapped due to collisions with the solar wind and form a radiation belt around the sun. I really wonder how the astronauts got through the Van Allen belts, or whether they just got fried and NASA said, well, tough luck, or that their spaceship protected them. On the shores of the Great Lakes will appear a few dozen times a year, but on at least two occasions, auroras have manifested themselves simultaneously in the northern and southern hemisphere. Well, of course, Bucko, because it's at an equinox. Equinox is the same in north and southern hemisphere. On the 1st of September 1770, so that would be Cook's cruise, when one was observed by Captain Cook, recorded another over the South Pacific, and then again in October 2001. Mm-hmm. Mercury and Jupiter, like Earth, are magnetized. They're not magnetized, they generate magnetic fields. No, I would disagree. And any planets with a magnetic field, which is not Mars, and an atmosphere will probably display auroras. But with the sole exception of Jupiter, which displays even more intense, powerful auroras than ours, none can compare with those found on the Earth in amplitude, duration, luminosity, and brilliance. I don't know where this has come from. One observer has described them as gigantuan, ghost-like arms chasing and darting, disappearing and appearing spontaneously, while another recorded different forms wavering many colours, diffusing and changing, sometimes far away, sometimes filling the heavens around and above, plunging great dropping spears and sheets of colour earthwards towards your very heads, as though a great hand were dropping colour like burning oil. So this is important. This is not directly the sun. People wouldn't have put this with the sun, but the sun is the source of the energy of these auroras. A combination of the sun and Earth's magnetic field. Scott, who lost to Edmondson in a race to the South Pole, okay, that sums him up, wrote how overwhelmed he felt before an aurora. By its delicacy in light and colour, its transparency, and above all, its tremendous evanescence of form. The appeal is to the imagination by the suggestion of something wholly spiritual. Auroras even make themselves heard, giving off a whistling, crackling noise, as if waving a large flag in a fresh gale of wind. Now, physics-wise, I cannot work out how that happens. So, how that could generate? So, it is interesting. I have to look that up. The late 18th century American historian Jeremy Belknap compared the sound with a muted rustling or whishing, like a rushing of one's thumb or forefingers down a silk scarf. Giant plumes of gas that burst on the edge of our atmosphere was first given the poetic life, in the apocryphal books of the Maccabees. Horsemen charging in midair, clad in garments interwoven with gold. In Norway, they were sometimes seen as Valkyries, choosers of the slam. The Inuit believed they were the dead reaching towards those left behind, or spirits playing football with the walrus skulls. I love that one. obviously if you want walruses, you need a walrus. Apparently walrus is the most disgusting food, and caused basically almost a mutiny when Cook says, go to eat that walrus. Cook went everywhere and got his crew to eat everything they saw. Okay, I don't know why they did that. Part of the experiment. But walrus is apparently awful. And now I looked at the internet and found some walrus recipes. That tells you you just can't trust anything on the internet, including this. In the Middle Ages, the lights were taken as a cause of plague or disaster, while during the English Civil Wars of the 17th century, people saw a fiery, shaking sword with a blue handle. And recently, in 1802, Walter Scott wrote, quote, he knew by streamers that shot so bright that the spirits were riding the northern light. One of the things I want to say is that when you read in detail about some of these ancient civilizations, when they realized, the priests realized that they could control people by predicting disasters, people would go up and say, oh, look, I'm just checking out, should I be doing this? And if they said yes, the three soothsayers said yes, and one said, no, mate, it's going to be a bloody awful. People will go, I better listen to the bloody awful one. So there's a tendency for any prediction mechanism to give warnings. There's news in it. Like, I put in a termite detector, and it says there's no termites. Well, no. But if I put in a termite detector and it picks up termites, that's a victory. I want to pay money for people who have successful termite detectors. Okay, there's different aspects of it. You can mention this going through. After the Aurora Borealis in 14th of November 1837, one scientist in New Haven, America, I suppose, reported about 6 in the evening, the sky was thick with falling snow, but everything suddenly appeared as if dyed in blood. Tree, housetops, entire atmospheres were tinged with scarlet, so much as the people thought the town on fire. 6 is probably sunlight involved in there. Okay, there's an asterisk here. The AD 37 Emperor Tiberius saw a vivid reddish light in the sky, and Seneca reports, Seneca is the most irritating philosopher. He's a hallmark philosopher. He's a greeting card philosopher which sits in here. Battalions were hurriedly dispatched to Ostia, a vital seaport at the Tiber mouth, in the belief that it was burning. Then, in London in 1839, fire brigades rushed towards north to put out a conflagration that turned out to be an aurora in January 38. There it was called out again, this time in the belief the fires were sweeping Windsor Castle. The Associated Press reported the ruddy glow led many to think half the city was ablaze. Contrawise, in Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, of course, you can just quote fiction and reality, anything. Maxim de Winter, driving frenetically back to the Cornish mansion, sees the evening sky emblazoned in the garden shadows. That's not the Northern Lights, he cries. It's Mandarin. Okay. So it's a general thing. The aurora lasted for half an hour before diffusing, like a light of an astral lamp. Elsewhere in the US, great streamers appeared, bright red and vertical commas, alternating with white clouds before diffusing at their apexes. Sounds like a weather phenomenon to me, not the Northern Lights. Then about 9 p.m, innumerable arches of brilliant scarlet shot up in the northern arc of the horizon, like the striped inside of a gorgeous circus tent. Similar phenomena were reported that night in Pennsylvania. It just sounds like a soul storm hitting them. Maryland, Georgia, Ohio, sometimes accompanied by what observers called merry dances, great plumes of color liberated into movement. Simultaneously, auroras appeared above many parts of Europe, a patch of the most intense blood-red color ever seen. Such vivid colors has a simple explanation. Atmospheric nitrogen will make auroras purple-violet, while oxygen makes them green and red. For the interactions take place at high altitudes. But the lights can also appear reddish pink and greenish yellow, or with violet sheen intermingled with pastel pinks and green. Yeah, that's, oxygen itself, but metastable oxygen has got that deep, deep red colour. I should know, because I did a PhD on it. Although auroras glows have been known to reach as far equatorward as Italy and France, they are seen that close only about once every 10 years. We still don't know exactly what sets off these spectral lights displays. Although in 2007, NASA launched 5 spacecraft, each about the size of a washing machine, to try and solve the mystery. Initial findings show they follow the snapping of magnetic fields, whatever that means, similar to the blowing of an electric fuse. I think that's deeply confused about plasma. Plasma streamers and magnetic field lines. So the streamers can break, but you can't break a magnetic field lines by definition. Scientists involved hope that more information about the next peak of solar storms arrived between 2010 and 2011. Meanwhile, auroras continue to fill us with wonder, with many, which may be why so much superstition still surrounds them. Quote, this is from auroras. Very different from any auroras in the famous but extremely rare green flash, usually described as emerald green, like copper coins lighting our retinas. So a copper is when you put copper in a flame, you get this green color. One witness remembers it, which the literature of its own, Jules Verne, claiming a green that no artist could ever obtain on his palette, a green which is true because it depends what the spectral colours is, but if it's one or two spectral lines, you're outside your colour palette. So this is why I really enjoy you can get the colours fairly good on your computer, but you can't get an artist's palette. I just really like that. Okay, that's just weird. A green which neither varied tints of vegetation or shades of most limpid sea could ever produce the like. If there is a green in Paris, it cannot but be of this shade, which is what I said about spectral lines. Spectral lines are ghostly. So if you get a spectrograph, the colours in that rainbow of the spectrograph are these pure single frequencies, which don't occur in nature. The flashes appear at sunrise and sunset on the horizon, usually over the ocean, when some part of the sun suddenly seems to change colour. And there may be a few seconds when the sky, the sun's red is blocked by the Earth's rim, turns green or even violet. The phenomenon has been seen in the Caribbean, Mediterranean and Japan, over the waters of the Antarctic and even the equatorial Peruvian jungle at sunrise. I think this is the phenomenon of, I think it's called the green flash. My dad, we used to watch the sunset out of Adelaide and said, watch really carefully when the sunset, there's a little green flash. So I'll look that up. I think he's got confused. This is the obvious thing. I say this author's confused. I go and research and there's confusion out there, either in my head or his head or everyone's head. The most economical definition of eclipse, this is a different thing, comes from the Italian Book of Eclipses. Okay. Eclipses, an astronomical introduction for humanists and runs. An eclipse occurs when 3 celestial bodies are in the same direction so that one of them obstructs the reciprocal visibility of the other 2. What we know about the plane of the Earth's orbit around the Sun is called the ecliptic because eclipses can take place only when the Sun and Moon are both situated on a plane of the Earth's path. In short, a lunar eclipse is caused by the Earth coming between the Sun and the Moon, blocking the sunlight and usually reflects off the Moon and makes it visible. A solar eclipse occurs when the Moon passes between the Earth and the Sun, obscuring the Sun. Our Moon is unusually large and both actually to other moons and relatively to the planet. It orbits, and for a total eclipse to take place, it has to be in exactly the right place. And Earth has to be exactly the right distance from the Sun. Sometimes the Earth and the Sun are closest, making the Sun seem slightly larger. The Moon will mask only about 98% of it, leaving a circle of visible light, causing known as an annual eclipse from the Latin annulus ring. Possibly an even more dramatic sight than the total darkening. Usually the Moon cuts across only a section of the Sun, causing a partial eclipse. On such occasions, only about 1/6 of the Earth's surface encounters some part of the Moon's shadow. I think that's complete bollocks. Yeah, that's just described information stuck it again. One day, In the future, there will be no total eclipses. Obviously, the moon's getting further out. Observed from the Earth, the sun and the moon, in this epoch at least, have almost the same apparent diameters, as their sizes are the same ratio as their distances. Beautiful. The sun is just 400 times broader than the moon, but just under 400 times further away. An extraordinary coincidence, which over hundreds of millions of years will not endure, because the distances between the sun and the earth and the moon, are very slowly increasing. But the moon is increasing at farther, greater rate. The moon, but the earth is slowing down, and the moon, obviously the moon is slowing down, but our tide will get tidally locked. The moon will eventually stop orbiting. There you go. Well, it will orbit, but it will be hanging in the same spot in the sky. Obviously, over Australia, we bags it. Initially, the moon orbited close to Earth, perhaps just 16,000 miles, which is 20,000 kilometres. Now, that's very close. It's now 400,000 kilometres. Today, it averages 200 or some other miles. The slowing effects of tidal friction of our planet will continue to press the moon into an inexorable concentric outward spiral at a rate of 1.5 inches a year, 3 centimetres a year. We don't call it friction, we just say it's conservation of angular momentum. So the moon gains angular momentum as we lose angular momentum. Eventually, some hundreds of million years hence, it will be too far off to cover the sun from our view. For as long as we have record, eclipses have awakened fear and endless end of the world imagining independent of the mythology or culture. Eclipses, as well as other heavenly occurrences, were believed to be almost impossible to predict, such as auroras, comets and meteors and showers. This is the entire thing. He missed out comets and meteor showers. I describe a Greek word meaning the stars aligned against you. Diastra means star against her. Oh, diastra. Eclipse itself comes from the Greek, which means abandonment and forsaken. The Chinese word for translate has been eaten away. Rishi literally means sun eat. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Eclipse means, what's it, abandonment. In Spanish, the word means to make dim or indistinct, the Russian to black out. For the Kakeol tribe in North America, it glosses as the sun carries sickness, a belief shared by many cultures. In Asian folklore, children born in the moment of the deepest darkness will emerge from mutant death. Even today, many Thais hoard black joss sticks and jelly and sacrifice black chickens to Horu, the sun-devouring demon, for their ancestors did, and give the eclipse tainted goods as alms to beggars in the belief that their sins will be redeemed by their donations. What? Okay. Oh, they will give eclipse-tainted goods, so if the eclipse comes, they'll give them off to beggars, don't eat them. In India, that is the most enduring superstitions are found. Only a little over a decade ago, the JJ, a village in Punjab, pregnant women were warned not to venture outside during an eclipse lest their babies be born blind with a cliff path. Food cooked before the eclipse must be thrown out as impure. Anyone wielding a knife or an axe is believed to be risking an accident. Cows are kept indoors, obviously, being a Hindu Indian, while children must either go to the temple or remain at home. On the 22nd, you don't want the cows at the temple, do you? On the 22nd of July 2009, the strongest longest solar eclipse of the century, 6 minutes and 39 seconds, was best seen from Varanasi, the holy city in northern central India. 3 years before, I had travelled there to meet a Sanskrit scholar from one of the city's 5 universities. We're sitting in the courtyard with cows and rabbits wandering about, and there's children, all 9 of them, peeping around corners to take in the strange visitor. I was silly, and I was away from home during the last eclipse, said Dr. Sandruka Mishra, pulling his worn white dhoti. Nobody took the cows inside, with the result that one pointed a light brown 3-year-old, was born blind. Sure enough, the great mound of excess skin rose up over the cow's lower eyelids, making it almost impossible for the poor animal to see. Dr. Mishra had gone on to explain that for Hindus, solar eclipses were khaki polluting. The obliteration of the sun, even for a moment, was a terrible omen. When such event was due, a special ritual known as the Homa was held, which involved offering a consecrated fire followed by Suryangarana, solar eclipse bujarite, and a chanting of hymns. Pregnant women had their bellies smeared with a mixture of ghee, clarified butter, and cow dung, as stipulated in the Vedic scriptures. I think this is okay because this is a one-on-one account. I allow this. If this was hearsay, I'd just be really upset. In Varanasi, after the eclipse, Hindus made their way to one particular pond in the center of the city and immersed themselves in. I had seen the pond, about 50 feet square. 50 feet square, it seems like a small swimming pool. It must have been packed. Ritual cleansings like this still carried out all over India, which is true. Because the early society experienced eclipses as a crucial disorder, they tried to incorporate them into their world with something that they could be readily understood. In the Quran, they are punishments from God, and one must abase oneself to avoid further divine displeasure. North American Indians believed eclipses were the fault of dogs and coyotes. Imagine being a bloody dog. What are you being blamed for? Chew the slippers, your moccasin slippers. They have to be moccasins, wouldn't they? I see your moccasins, mate. I didn't fetch the arrow. And you bloody caused that eclipse, you bloody mongrel. South American tribesmen blamed the jaguar. And Bari of Brazil believed the enormous black bird spread its wings over the sun. The list goes on. Following the eclipse, any setback, death, or monarch defeated in battle would be carefully noted in belief that any future darkenings at the same point of the solar year would inflict a similar misfortune. Okay, you can't tell what the eclipse is going to do, but previously, last eclipse, that person got run over, or got killed by food poisoning at the market, by tainted goods. And thus, it became important to be able to predict when eclipses might occur, and the early glimmerings of science were to shed light on the future it might bring. The Babylonians, who are just a totally unrelated culture as far as I'm concerned, who discovered that solar eclipses form the pattern. In the course of a year, the Earth's passages may appear the Sun is moving through a cycle. When the Earth has gone 19 times around the Sun and the Moon 223 times around the Earth, a particular eclipse of exactly the same type will repeat itself. Also, there had been a lunar eclipse at dawn, 18th of May 2603 BC, which is after the Babylonians. One could have forecast that the most identical eclipse would occur on the 20th of May in 385 BC. To recognise such a pattern over such an extended time was an extraordinary accomplishment. For so early a civilization. I think you'd find the Babylonians were really disappeared by then. By the end of the 3rd millennium BC, okay, the Babylonians were maintaining a chart of sun and weather omens such as lightning, thunder and earthquakes. Hopefully lightning and thunder go together. With this in hand, they tried to outwit the heavens. When eclipse was forecast, some lowly individual would be selected to stand in for a king until the event passed, to make it clear that he was to suffer the impending evils. The substitute king would be forced to listen to the readings of the portents. The true king remained out of sight, undergoing intensive rites of purifications. Letters written to real rulers would be addressed to him as farmer. But on the eclipse had passed, the minister would inquire of the farmer on which day the hapless decor would meet his fate, to be mourned as if he were indeed a fallen sovereign. What I was going to say is that this is okay. Just given that they know so little about Babylon, I don't know how this myth got out. It sounds as though he's picked it out of some kids' magazine. Babylonians would measure the eclipse. Now, what do I have to remember? A green flash. The Babylonians would measure the eclipse's degree of totality by stretching out a hand, arm's length, in front of the eye. This method, later adopted by the Greeks, used for a finger or finger's breadth to mean a unit of measurement. 12 fingers, oddly, identifying a total eclipse. Not in Babylonian. fractions for me, what I know about Babylonian mathematics. The first total eclipse for which we have a record is set down in Chinese book of the Chun Chui as having occurred on the 17th of July 709 BC, a date agreeing exactly with the modern computations. I think this is a bit wanky. Ancient China left behind a huge number of records up until the Qing dynasty at 1644. There are about 1,000 references to these heavenly darkenings, exactly forecasting was desperately important. Hence, those who managed it won considerable prestige, and with people were not slow to hazard guesses, however wild. But forecasting was no easy matter. The Babylonians may have achieved it to a certain extent, but few cultures did. To predict a solar eclipse in Herodotus' day, for example, one would have had to know certain astronomical facts that came to light only in the 3rd century BC. Aha, what a loser. But what I was going to say is today that marketing management firms recruit scientists to predict the stock market. In the 2nd century BC, Hipparchus, according to Pliny, in what one might call a solar legend, forecast the motions of the sun and the moon for 600 years. 300 years later, in about AD 150, Claudius Ptolemy, 13th book's description of the universe, the Almagest, laid out purportedly scientific system for judging eclipses. Such was his authority and his views, for all their inaccuracy, enjoyed a wide prolonged currency for some 1,500 years. Let's see what he said. In 1652, the volumes dealing with such matters were republished as an ease and familiar method whereby to judge the effects of depending on eclipses. There's a lot of rubbish in Ptolemy, and really his circle method only worked for a little while ahead. So Ptolemy was the circle guy, these more circles. He stuck with the known, the common sense that everything must be circles. For hundreds of years, these dread occasions were predicted and recorded as warnings, criticism, confirmation as appropriate. During times of the Civil War in medieval Japan, the court astrologers tended to over-predict. If nothing happened, they were rewarded for having prevented an occlusion. Chinese astronomers, on the other hand, would use predictions in highly political ways. If they disapproved of the ruler, they would meticulously record an eclipse that occurred, which had been taken as a divine rebuke of the government. Because eclipses were considered warnings from heaven, these might announce a totally fictitious, they might announce a totally fictitious one. This happened in 186 BC during the reign of a deeply unpopular Empress Ku Tu Su. However, if they approved the rules, astronomers might just as readily omit all record of an eclipse that had actually taken place. The belief in eclipse passage misfortune kept Chinese astrologers close to the seats of power. Which, of course, you've got to, you don't want someone away from you making prediction, because the enemies will take it across. The belief that eclipses, okay, one might imagine a shortage of ensuing disasters would have devalued their status. But the fates threw up just enough occasions to support their authority. For instance, almost immediately after the eclipse on both the 4th of March 181 BC and January 18th 121 BC, the Dowager Empress of China met her death. And less than a year after the eclipse on 28th of August 360 AD, the Emperor Mu died, aged only 19. Humankind seems to have an unquenchable thirst for superstition. Come on, this is going to go far reading. This is a long chapter. And most societies have assumed that great events in the universe at large are co-joined with those in human world. In the cases of eclipses, they are often believed to be markers of death of a famous person or some other momentous occasion. Every time after such an accident, Machiavelli says scornfully, you get some such extraordinary event turning up. Thus, random acts of history seem to confirm superstition. Pragmatism could sometimes triumph over folklore, however. In his Life of Pericles, Plutarch recounts that an annual eclipse, now identified as the 3rd of August 1431. It's interesting that the eclipse now date these faulty records, so terrified the Athenian sailors that they threatened to desert an expedition against the Lacedaemonians. Seeing the pilot of his galley was filled with alarm, Pericles doffed his cloak and cast it over the man's head. Is there anything so terrible as that? And then the man gave a muffled no. Pericles asked if the difference between a cloak and an eclipse except size. The fleet set sails. Well, there you go. Emperor Claudius also deployed common sense before the eclipse of the 1st of August AD 45, which astrologers had told him would fall on his birthday, when they went on to say that their omens predicted rites against him. As a consequence, Claudius put out a public announcement of the intimate event, describing it as the kind of eclipse that would be annular, and explaining to the citizens how such celestials had come apart. His birthday came uneventfully. Well, that's good on you, Claudius. I really like Claudius. Foreknowledge of eclipses could be used to exploit superstition as well as diffuse it. More than once, a ruler whose priests had predicted a solar eclipse would rely on panic he knew would ensue to send troops to storm the enemy city. In July 1917, after a long desert trek, T. Lawrence and his Arab irregulars closed with Aqaba, now Jordan's only port, which they planned to take from the Turks. Lawrence knew that a lunar eclipse was due on the 6th and held back his troop until the garrison, alarmed by the loss of the moon, set about frightening off the devouring monster with the usual assortment of drum hammering and clacson and shouting. That gave Lawrence his moment and Aqaba fell. That is an interesting thing. Okay, well, that's the lunar eclipse. Sometimes, though, there was really consequence on Earth for what happened in the heavens. In 1183, a brutal three-year civil war between Minato and Tira clans was ravaging in Japan. But just as the Minato were preparing to battle, the sun was put out. Having no rational explanation for the calamity, they took to the heels. At other times, the connection between the eclipse and events appears to have been fabricated. There is a famous case, the datable to the 20th of May 585 BC, when Medes and Lydians were more than 5 years at war, made peace, supposedly because an eclipse put a sudden end to a major battle. Herodotus and Pliny both record such events as taking place. The former writer that the great astronomer Thales had predicted a solar eclipse for that exact year. That's interesting. Thales, that's really interesting about Thales. I have to go back and reread about them. Even so, an introduction is most likely mythical, with both historians guilty of political spin combining the eclipse and a battle from two different dates. Herodotus also seems to have described an eclipse that never took place at all, describing how one shadowed Xerxes of Persia as he set out to conquer Greece. Modern computations can find no eclipse at this time. Isn't that amazing? Well, it could happen. I believe there's other things. Eclipses seem to have unhinged even normally authoritative resources. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle that registered the reign of Alfred the Great in the mid-12th century. Okay, so I'll find this. Alfred the Great. In the year 1135 AD, King Henry went across the sea to Lammas, and the next day he was lying asleep aboard a ship. It grew dark over land. Sun became as if there were three nights odd moon. People were much astonished and terrified, and said there would be something important that would bound to come after this, and so it did. And during the same year, the king died. Henry I, whose age the chronicle paints as racked with misery, did indeed die exactly 2 months later. But the eclipse described actually took place 2 years before. Another legend has that the heavens similarly making the earth early death of Anne Neville, 1450
685, wife of Richard III. Rumour ran that the sun had hid its face because King Richard had poisoned the Queen. Oh, there you go. Isn't that crap? It's like HSC results. He got great results because of this. Basically, you get good HSC results if your students work their asses off. Okay. I don't know how long. I'll read another paragraph of this and stop. Oh, in fact, I'll stop at this page. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. I'll continue soon. I'm back reading. Unfortunately, halfway through the chapter, I had to go out, attend a memorial service, and that went for a fair time. I'm still being attacked by parrots. God, start of the day. I did various problem solving. Oh, God, I'm being attacked by parrots at the moment. Getting back to it on page 68, and we've got to get up to page... Oh, let's go through it. It's not too many pages. 68 to 72. So that's actually six more pages. Okay, eclipses, which going back means... I forgot what the Greek word for eclipse was, but it means something. There's thales, the stuff. It means sun eat. Eclipse against diastra, against star, Chinese sun eat, blackout. Eclipses. I can't remember what the word eclipse means, but I'll get on the origin of it. There you go. Fortunately, the parrots have decided to go off and leave me alone. Okay. So, eclipses have been used to date historical events. Thus, one is recorded 11 days before Alexander overthrew King Darius in Arebla. And by working out events retrospectively, one can mark the battle as fought on the 21st of October, 331 BC. Such claims are made with varying degrees of accuracy. The great Johannes Kepler, who precisely calculated the world's creation day as 23 July 3999 BC. That's really interesting that you've got Kepler and you've got all these things. Tales as an astronomer. When you read the philosophy books about him, you don't get that. And Kepler, you don't get the fact that he was off doing wacko things like that. And coupled it with an eclipse, indeed, these feature in similar ways in the creation stories of several cultures and in attempts to date important events in religious history. The birth of our Lord Saviour itself, quite positively fixed, contended one 19th century divine. It said that said in the Bible that Herod died when Jesus was still a child, and probably a few months after his birth. Now the Jewish historian Josephus tells us there was an eclipse during Herod's last illness, and that this eclipse was known to have occurred in April, and certainly in a certain year of what is called the Julian period. It is quite clearly shown that our Saviour must have been born just about the time the Bible states he was. Okay. There you go. So eclipses go in there, part of religious beliefs. Even more ominous darkening, the only one to shadow Jerusalem during Christ's public ministry, is said by the church historians to have occurred on the day of his crucifixion. They describe it as being total, beginning at noon and passing across the Black Sea from near Odessa on the Persian Gulf. Matthew, Mark and Luke, probably using a common source, all invoke it in their narratives. According to all three, isn't that amazing? From the sixth hour, there was darkness all over the land until the ninth hour. Well, gee, that's a pretty long eclipse, isn't it? Oh, the mosquito is just having a big blood eat. Okay, so I'm out here in the garden reading. Okay, according to all three, from this, Luke adding, and the sun lights failed, but Jesus was crucified at the Passover, a spring full moon festival, when the moon had to be the opposite side of the earth. So no eclipse lasts anywhere as long as 3 hours, the gospel narratives reclaim. Okay, well, isn't that amazing? So it couldn't have been because the moon was at the wrong side. Everywhere in the world, people have reacted to eclipses with profound fear, yet simple explanation of what they were was put forward as far back as the 6th century BC, when then Thales, who's one of my favourite people, proposed an answer. A century later, his fellow countryman and fellow astronomer, Anaxagoras, 500 to 428 BC, was to write, "The moon has not any light of its own, but derives it from the sun. Eclipses of the moon are due to it screening the earth, and sometimes by the bodies beneath the moon. Those of the sun, to screening the moon when it is new. For this, however, Anaxagoras was indicted for atheism and condemned to death." He chose exile instead. Isn't that crazy? So I think there was another person who got a piece of rock, you know, a meteorite fell, and he said, well, the sun's composed of something. And the link between eclipses and misfortune continued unbroken for another 2,000 years. Certainly it was still going strong in the early 19th century when Archbishop Lyons appointed by Charlemagne, witnessed 3 lunar eclipses in a single year and recorded that each time his terrified flock took to the 9th century, not the 19th century, blowing horns, hammering on metal instruments and screaming, "Vince Luna," urging the moon to fight back. The church officially forbade such a behaviour. It would be repeatedly due in centuries to come. But it was no match for the strength of the superstition after all. The monster did always retreat. Even the great emperor himself was not immune. In 810, Charlemagne was just over 70 when the solar and lunar eclipse fell within 2 weeks of each other, which is okay. It has to be within 2 weeks because it takes 2 weeks for the moon to flip to the other side of the earth. 30th of November and 14th of December. And alarmed him into immediately preparing his will. By the end of January, he was dead. Almost 30 years later, on the 5th of May, 840, a solar eclipse lasting nearly 6 minutes so frightened Charlemagne's son, Louis the Pious, that he too fell ill and died before June was out. The bitter struggle for his throne led to the historic Treaty of Verdun dividing Western Europe into 3 major areas we now know as France, Germany and Italy. Popular attitudes were a little changed even into the 7th century. The ominous conjunction of a full solar and lunar eclipses within weeks of one another, albeit rare, was particularly alarming. When this happened in October 1605, Shakespeare used it as a powerful metaphor for the sense of impending doom, incorporating it into the first act of King Lear, in which Gloucester invokes the recent horrors. These late eclipses of the sun and moon portend no good to us. Through the wisdom of nature can reason it thus, and thus yet nature finds itself scourged by sequent effects. Love cools, friendship falls off, brothers divide, in cities immunities, in countries discord, in palaces treason, and the bond cracked twixt son and father. This villain of mine comes under the prediction. There's son against father, king falls from bias of nature. There's father's against child. He wanders off, leaving his bastard son Edmund alone on the stage. Gloucestershire is a good man, yet a gullible one, as we are soon to see again with his other son Edgar. Watching, and a creature of the time in his acceptance of superstition. Edmund, on the other hand, may be the play's villain, but he is also supreme rationalist. Here he has Shakespeare's tongue. This is an excellent floppery of the world, that when we are sick in fortune, often the surfeit of our own behaviour, we make guilty our disasters of the sun, the moon, and the stars. If we were villains by necessity, fools by heaven's compulsion, knaves, thieves, and treacherous by spherical predominance, drunkards and liars and adulterers by enforced obedience to planetary influence, and all we are in evil by divine thrusting on, an admirable evasion, a whore master man, to lay his goatish deposition to the charge of a star. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, congratulations, Richard Cohen. You've managed to get Shakespeare into this, and it's beautiful. I would read it again, but my reading of Shakespeare is so poor. But there I say, I am getting a cognitive rebound because I can at least read that. Shakespeare's skepticism was shared by his king. That same year, after a 90% eclipse, James I wrote a satirical letter to Lord Salisbury illuminating all the evils that his subjects might ascribe to the sun's temporary occlusion. For James, the superstitions attached to forecasting were the devil's work, and he wanted them outlawed. Monarchs and playwrights alike proved singularly unsuccessful in changing opinion. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, you're basically a Shakespeare yourself, even though. John Milton was born 3 years after the first production of King Lear. In 1838, he published Lycidas, which laments the death of Cambridge contemporary King Edward, cast away when his ship floundered off the English coast. It was that fatal and perfidious bark built in the eclipse and triggered with cursed dark that sunk so low that sacred head of thine. The same year he published Lycidas, Milton took a continental tour during which he visited Galileo under house arrest in Florence. This is interesting. The greatest astronomer had fallen frail and blind, yet the two men I didn't know that Galileo had turned blind. There you go. For some time, and one would like to think that the causes of the eclipse would have figured in their conversation. The superstition held sway even over a mind as sophisticated as Milton's. In Paradise Lost, his description of the faded splendour of a fallen archangel captures the state of unease that most people still feel in the face of an eclipse. As when the sun, new risen, looks through the horizontal misty air, shorn of his beams and from behind the moon, its dim eclipse, disastrous twilight sheds on half the nations, and with fear of change perplexes monarchs. Okay, paradox. Let's see his footnote. Paradise Lost was not completed until 1665, when censorship was severe. One of the chaplains through whom the Archbishop of Canterbury gave or refused publishing licenses found this passage objectionable. Following the death of Cromwell and in the turbulent days of Charles II return to power, the lines were seen as dangerous, imputing to monarchs perplexity and fear of change. The poem was allowed to see the light of day only through the intersection of intellectual friends of the poet. Well, that's interesting. I love the mix of poetry. Poetry is, let's face it, looking at the stars and ascribing shapes and myths to stars is the ultimate in, my Godfather. What's that? Oh, sorry. I'm just looking up here. I'm just a bit distracted by, we've got a citrus tree which is attacked by legions of citrus bugs. So it's really hard to see how these trees survive and produce any fruit with the amount of bugs on them. But an aside, it's really interesting to see that different degrees of lateral thinking are really necessary to link with the humanity of it all, in that the stars and the shapes and indeed in terms of Milky Way and the legends is obviously an example of extreme lateral thinking. If I see several dots and I see them move and I invent a story about them, that's lateral thinking. Of course, poetry is a beautiful example of a connection between lateral thinking and the world. Okay. By the time Milton finished his great work, mentioned in Eclipses in Book 2, lines 663-6, and Book 10 in lines 410-414, he too was completely blind. Well, that's amazing. He had struggled with poor eyesight since childhood, and was, as early as 1664, had already lost most of the vision in his left eye. For the next 5 years, he tried various remedies to stave off this fate. But on March 1652, at the age of 43, he had to accept that both eyes had failed him, without any hope of day. In Samson's Antigonus in 1671, which is a fair number, he portrays Samson's railing in words that might have been his own. Oh, dark, 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 amidst the blaze of the noon, irrevocably dark, total eclipse, without all hope of day. O first created beam, and thou grace word, let there be light and light over all. Why am I thus bereaved, my prime decree? The sun to me is dark, and the silent as the moon. So can I just say, one of the great things about having the, I suppose the vascular stuff treated isn't, my eyesight's improved, I can hear in stereo, all this beautiful things. I used to have a bit of difficulty seeing. This is great. Coincidentally, on the 29th of March, 1652, by the old calendar, the very same month that Milton finally lost all sight, saw Black Monday, a solar eclipse that panicked all Britain. The rich loaded up their coaches with and fled from London, and there was a thriving trade in a variety of cordials supposed to allay ill effects. At the Dalkeith in Scotland, the poor threw away their possessions, casting themselves on their backs and their eyes towards heaven, praying almost passionately that Christ would let them see the sun again and save them. It was left to the diarist, John Evelyn, to maintain a sceptical spirit. It was celebrated, it was that celebrated eclipse of the sun, so much threatened by astrologers and so exceedingly alarmed the whole nation, so as hardly anyone would work. None stir out of their houses, so ridiculously they were abused by knavish and ignorant stargazers. Not everyone reacted with such alarm. Samuel Pepys mentions that during a later spring occlusion, his doctor's daughter, having risen at dawn, was concentrating so hard on composing her letter that not until about 9 o'clock, although she was in the midst of almost total eclipse, did she even notice that the light from the sun looked somewhat dim. But she was an exception. In Paris, people flocked to the confession in such numbers over the days leading up to the eclipse forecast on the 21st of August, 1664, that one priest felt obliged to declare that the event had been put off for 2 weeks in order to manage the crowds of penitents. In cities in Western Europe, however, the days of superstition ignorance were numbered, for the march of science was accelerating. Thus, the great astronomer Edmund Halley was able to predict the total solar eclipse on the 3rd of May, 1715, which covered almost the entire south of England for more than 3 minutes. So that carefully observed, he could estimate the width of its track. He had readings taken from 15 different points along its path, which enabled him to calculate the sun's diameter with greater accuracy than ever before. Thomas Crump, in his wide-ranging survey of the history of eclipses, declared that Halley's observations, quote, can be taken to be the beginning of modern eclipse astronomy. Fear and awe remained, but they were now augmented by knowledge. This beautiful, beautiful chapter. And I'm just going to finish this off by reading the Shakespeare quote again, because it, I just want to burn it into my head. I've really forgotten what it was. I think it was the Edmund saying, it's, yeah, saying, look, you can do this. And this is really interesting in that, that superstition abounds in many, many places. This is the excellent floppery of the world, that when we are sick in fortune, often the surfeit of our own behaviour, we make guilty of our disasters as the sun, the moon and the stars, as if we were villains by necessity, fools by heavenly compulsion, knaves and thieves and treacherous by spherical predominance, drunkards and liars and adulterers by enforced obedience to planetary influence, and by that we are evil in by divine thrusting on, an admirable evasion of a whoremaster to lay his goatous deposition to the charge of a star. So that's that we've all been pimped by the sun. Now you can see that I'm beginning to read. That's the best I've read Shakespeare in a fair while. Thanks for listening. I'll get back on to different readings. Podcast.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.